So one of the unexpected pleasures of gathering online has been the opportunity to see the Lydian animals who slink across the Zoom screen and leap into the labs of their humans. And today is the feast of St. Francis of Assisi, which gives us a chance to celebrate those animals and perhaps learn from them too. I grew up with dogs. And if you've spent time around dogs, you've noticed what happens when you say good dog. The ears go back, the tail wags, maybe the dog anticipates a T-R-E-A-T or a walk. But I also see the dog affirming what I've just said. Good. I know. I'm here right now. Being me, and that's good. I'm projecting, of course, but this imagined dog thought has helped me understand the opening of Genesis. The constant refrain in the passage we just heard is, God saw that it was good. Note the difference between God saw that it was good and God saw that it was outstanding. The second version, when I say it, I almost feel some tension. And that tension points me back towards what I think the passage conveys, which is that God saw creation, oceans, mountains, forests, rivers, birds, fish, slugs, pythons, seaweed, amoeba, not as A-plus work, but as endowed with goodness. The very good at the end of the passage simply emphasizes the abundance of that goodness. We are part of that creation. And our goodness is realized in our mere existence. We're here, and that's good. If we were to live in right relationship with each other and with the rest of creation and with God, we have to lie down in the garden of Genesis and feel our endowed goodness. And that's so hard to do. One thing you don't encounter in dogs is imposter syndrome. The idea that I'm a fraud, I don't belong here. If you say good dog, the dog's physical response never seems to say, well, that's nice of you to say. Dogs have no trouble accepting themselves. Accepting themselves is not even a thing for dogs. They just are themselves. We humans are different. I've struggled with imposter syndrome nearly my whole life. My dad was a physicist, and as a kid, I'd roam the parties thrown by my parents and their friends, most of them professors, and I'd hear how my dad and his fellow scientists spoke of their colleagues. Got his PhD at Stanford, did his postdoc at Princeton, a first-rate low-temperature guy doing excellent work in solids. I grew up breathing in the culture of achievement and the ideology that physics and math stood atop the ladder of knowledge. And at a certain point, when my father, highly accomplished and perched atop that ladder, smiled down at me, I realized I wasn't ever going to reach his expectations. I like to play drums to top 40 radio. I wasn't ever going to become a first-rate, low-temperature guy doing excellent work in solids. My imposter syndrome followed me to college, where I felt like an intellectual fraud, and then a spiritual fraud, and eventually ended up in the psych ward of the infirmary. After college, I fought imposter syndrome when I worked day jobs to support my fledgling music career. And then when success came, I still felt like a fraud. Yes, people like our band, but only because of the other two guys. Then I became a writer. Yes, I published a book, but only because my band was successful, which was because of my bandmates, and so on. I created austere regimens, hours of writing and drumming a day, hoping finally to prove it to myself that I really am a drummer and a writer. Regiment would fall apart, leaving shame in its wake. I tell my closest friends about my self-doubts, and they reply, no, no, you're a great drummer. No, you're a great writer. But by addressing and engaging the question of my merit, it only took me deeper into the imposter syndrome. And perhaps some of you recognize that cycle. Finally, I ended up teaching writing to college undergraduates and MFA students. And my imposter syndrome started to ease. Maybe it was because now I had the chance to be the professor I had needed when I was in school, or maybe even the professor I had needed at those parties I roamed as a kid. One of the first things I noticed is that I picked up a habit from an old mentor of mine, Donald Schell. Donald, who some of you here know, was one of the priests at St. Gregory's Church in San Francisco, where I used to be a member and later became the church administrator. Whenever I come to Donald with a question or a problem, the first word out of his mouth was good. Donald, I know you've told me before, but what was the inspiration for that phrase, friend of God? Good. That's from The Life of Moses by Gregory of Nyssa. Donald, I know I was supposed to pick up the copying, but where is it being done again? Good. It's just past the coffee shop on the corner. Donald, I think I may have lost that donation check for thousands of dollars. Good. Let's think about where it might be. I hadn't put together why this was so powerful until I started teaching and students brought their questions and problems to me. And it was almost reflexive. Jake, I don't know what to write about. Good. Let's talk about it. Jake, I started my piece, but I can't figure out how to end it. Good. Let's think about some possible ending points. Jake, I haven't written for weeks. Good. Let's talk about your process. When I said good to them, I saw in the relaxing of their faces and bodies what Donald had done for me. Starting his replies with good told me, Jake, it's good that you're here. It helped me let go of trying to prove something. It let me relax into being myself. Connecting my students to that same understanding is vital. I want to ground them in the sense that their learning and their presence in the classroom is good, that nothing they write will make them more or less deserving of being there. There is no earning this good. There is only embracing it. Some students push back. Rip me to shreds, they say, practically begging. It's important to note that these are the students who are most blocked. They've turned writing into a moral struggle, and they're suspicious of having that struggle taken away from them. We might recognize ourselves in it. For instance, perhaps as you've listened to me describe my teaching methods, some part of you has thought, it may be very sweet to teach of Jake to teach this way, but that sounds a little bit like participation trophy bullshit. Good. It might interest you to know that once grounded in the idea that it's good that they're in my classroom engaging in the work, my students surprise themselves by working harder than ever. In fact, they tell me that mine is one of the most demanding classes they've taken. Being grounded in the belief that they belong in a classroom doesn't stop them from working. Quite the opposite, it allows them to access their creativity and push themselves, as it turns out they've always wanted to do. Seeing how well this worked for my students inspired me to start taking my own medicine. Instead of the old austere regimens designed to help me prove myself, I now set minimal goals. 15 minutes of writing and drumming a day. The minimal goal says, good, you're here, writing, drumming. The minimal goals remind me that the purpose of all practice is to remove gratuitous effort, to stop fighting my way into drumming and to relax into it, stop fighting my way into writing and relax into that. And if you've felt wisps of moral panic as I've described this approach, just know that my annual drumming and writing hours now far surpass what I did when I was aiming to be rigorous, when I was trying to prove my worthiness as a drummer and writer. Our society pretends to operate on merit, that what we have is proof of what we've done. But of course, in a country built on stolen land by the labor of enslaved people, where wealth is systematically stolen from the poor and given to the rich, where so many forms of oppression exist, the idea that ours is a meritocracy is a monstrous sham. But it's more than a sham, because even if we did live in a meritocracy, which would be a far fairer system than what we have now, such a society would still be an affront to the God of Genesis. The goodness with which Genesis says we are endowed is not something we pull ourselves up into as much as something below, waiting for us to fall back into it, if only we would let go. Trying to earn that goodness, I grip my sticks too tightly to prove something on the drums. Grounded in it, I relax into the groove. Trying to earn that goodness, I overwrite, hoping to look writerly. Grounded in it, I relax into being myself on the page. Trying to earn that goodness, I reach for virtue signaling to prove my moral, political, and spiritual credibility. Grounded in it, I begin to engage in tangible action. What struck me about watching the Lydian creatures interact with their humans is not only how readily they receive acknowledgement of their goodness, the effortless receiving of that goodness. Their affection says something to us. Good, you are overflowing with goodness. If we hear that as a sweet message, then we've missed something, because the thought that we are overflowing with goodness is deeply challenging. That's why holding an animal can put a lump in your throats and make your heart stop. Animals give us a glimpse into what we refuse to acknowledge about ourselves. Where in your life do you need to hear good? It's good that you are here. Where are you never told this by others or by yourself? What part of you wants to earn your goodness? What part of you never feels good enough? What if the Garden of Genesis is not waiting at the top of an endless rope ladder? What if it's something we fall back into? How might we let go of the rope ladder, fall back into the garden, and live there, grounded in the goodness which we, along with all of creation, are endowed? We share the sermon at St. Lydia's. We'll hold a moment of silence together and then share our stories.